Chapter 15. Is the Bill of Rights in the Shredder? In January 2011, I sued the federal government, specifically the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, that's assigned to do all the screening at airports. My reasoning was simple. I had a hip replacement a few years ago, and the titanium the surgeon implanted sets off the metal detectors. They'd previously used handheld wands to scan my body, but after I was subjected to a frontal pat-down, I sued on grounds that these things amounted to unreasonable search and seizure and violated my Fourth Amendment rights. It's unbelievable, but a district judge threw my case out of court last November, ruling that my lawyer should have filed it in a circuit court of appeals. That's how they get rid of cases these days, by claiming they don't have jurisdiction. How can a federal judge do that when it's a constitutional question? If she doesn't have jurisdiction, then no one does. How do you go to the Court of Appeals if you don't have a case to appeal? The Court of Appeals doesn't give you a jury or the right of discovery. This goes back to that scoundrel Woodrow Wilson and how he created the Federal Reserve. It's called administrative law. What happens is this. The president signs an executive order. Congress then approves that order and tells a department to carry it out. When that happens, it's above the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. So it basically turns Congress and the president into dictators. With the Federal Reserve, the Constitution states there shall be no central bank. But this is how Wilson and the big shots loopholed it and avoided the Constitution. Here was an interesting component to my case. The judge turned to me at a hearing in July and said, "Governor, could you cite the time that you were abused at an airport?" My attorney stepped in and said, "No. Because of national security, the TSA rules are not made known to the governor or anyone else. So how can you possibly cite an abuse when you don't know what the rules are?" And the judge acknowledged that. If they do something wrong, you can't call them on it because you, the public, are not made privy to the rules. That's absurd. I found it interesting that, about a week after my case got dismissed, the European Union prohibited using X-ray body scanners in airports because their ionizing radiation has been shown to damage DNA and cause cancer. The TSA had no comment, except to say that it deploys the most advanced technology available to provide the best opportunity to detect dangerous items, such as explosives. I'd call that avoiding the question, wouldn't you? It's like with steroids. Nobody knew back in the 70s or 80s what the 2-year outlook on steroids would be. Now you're seeing all these guys dying prematurely in their 50s, and clearly anabolic steroids played a big role in this. So what is it about airport security that they don't want us to know in terms of future health effects? Well, once again, follow the money. Michael Chertoff, who ran Homeland Security for a while under George W. Bush, today is a private security firm, the Chertoff Group, and included among its clients is Rapiscan. This is the leading company manufacturing the full-body scanning systems, which Chertoff was promoting at DHS back in 2005 when the government placed its first order. After the underwear bomber got arrested on Christmas 2009, the TSA ordered 300 machines from Rapiscan, even though, according to the Government Accountability Office, it remains unclear whether the scanners would have been able to detect the weapon. No matter. Since then, $118 million in stimulus funds went to purchase Rapiscan technology. The only other company making these scanners, L3 Systems, has as its chief lobbyist Linda Daschle, wife of the former Senate Majority Leader. Oh, by the way, an interagency report about radiation exposure from these machines concluded that pregnant women and children should not be scanned, even though the radiation levels are extremely small. What I want people to realize is when you go to any airport in America, you are not protected by the Bill of Rights. It does not apply. They can do what they want, and it's already starting to spread further. You're going to see Homeland Security in bus terminals and other public transportation, even down to the highways, which is happening already in Tennessee, where they're doing random checks of vehicles all across the state. The logic of Bill Gibbons, Tennessee's Department of Safety and Homeland Security Commissioner, is, where is a terrorist more apt to be found? Not these days on an airplane, more likely on the interstate. Not only can they scan and probe our body cavities at airports, now they can invade the contents of our cars. They're turning our country into East Berlin. It makes you wonder what's next for our right to freedom of movement. Never thought I'd even imagine that about my own country. John Pistol, an appropriate name for an ex-FBI agent who now runs the TSA, has said he wants to expand what's called a Visible Intermodal Prevention Response, VIPR, Viper Task Forces. There are currently 25 of these teams, which include TSA agents, federal air marshals, behavior detection, and canine officers. In over a year's time, they made more than 9,300 searches of our railway and bus stations, ports and ferries, subways, bridges, private cars, and trucks. In fiscal 2011, some $110 million got spent on surface transportation security, including the Viper program, compared to over $5 billion for airport security. Over at Homeland Security, they're testing a new technology called FAST, F-A-S-T. Don't you love these acronyms? This one stands for Future Attribute Screening Technology, which involves sensors that can check how quickly your eyes are blinking or how high your blood pressure is. There's also the Insider Threat Detection Project, looking for observable indicators of potential insider threats before the insider commits a hostile act, and the Violent Intent Modeling and Simulation Project, analyzing to determine whether radical groups are likely to engage in political violence. You can't make this stuff up. We're all potential suspects now. In 2010, the Office of Management and Budget reckoned that 31 separate federal agencies were involved in Homeland Security-related funding that year to the tune of more than $65 billion. The Census Bureau, which has itself been compromised by war on terror activities, mapping Middle Eastern and Muslim communities for counter-terrorism officials, estimated that federal Homeland Security funding topped $70 billion in 2010. But government officials acknowledge that much funding is not included in that compilation. Have you heard about the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, with its Homeland Battlefield provision? That they're planning on giving the military free rein to operate inside our own borders? Technically, it's a $660 billion military funding bill that authorizes things like pay raises and contracts, along with funding for weapons systems and the war in Afghanistan. But a provision in the bill means that, for the first time in our history, the government will be able to decide who goes to trial and who can get detained without due process by the military. In fact, military custody would be mandatory for most terrorist suspects. Early in December 2011, the Senate voted 86-13, and the House 283-136 to pass a bill that's been called an historic threat to American citizens by the ACLU, and was also opposed by Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, FBI Director Robert Mueller, and Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. They all say we're doing just fine in combating terrorism, and in fact, the military does not want new powers to interrogate and investigate terrorist suspects, especially those arrested in the United States. No matter, the final passage occurred on December 15th, which just happened to be the 220th anniversary of the ratification of the Bill of Rights. Ironic, isn't it? The only candidate in the presidential campaign fighting to stop the bill was Ron Paul. After first threatening to veto the legislation as inconsistent with the fundamental American principle that our military does not patrol our streets, President Obama changed his mind after a caveat was added saying that none of this could be construed as altering legal rights for Americans. He rang in the new year by signing the NDAA into law, saying he was only doing this to keep on funding our troops. By denying the very principles for which they're supposedly fighting and giving a president authoritarian powers, give me a fucking break. Supposedly, the bill would only impact a person who was a part of or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Check the language again, folks. What does substantially supported mean? Is it that much of a stretch to call those people occupying Wall Street and the ports associated forces that are engaged in hostilities? Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, one of the Senate bill's prime supporters, is very pleased that the law basically says for the first time that the homeland is part of the battlefield. If you're an American citizen and you betray your country, you're not going to be given a lawyer. I believe our military should be deeply involved in fighting these guys at home or abroad. Excuse me, Senator Graham? Have you read recently Article 3, Section 3 of the Constitution? It says flat out No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act, or on confession in open court. This bill in effect revokes the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which outlawed any law enforcement by the military within our borders. Colleen Raleigh was a special agent with the FBI turned whistleblower in questioning whether we've been told the whole truth about 9/11. Here's what she had to say recently. Does anyone remember that none of the first 1,000 people the FBI rounded up after 9/11 and who were imprisoned for several months, some brutalized, were ever charged with terrorism? Does anyone remember that hundreds of the Gitmo detainees who were handed over to their American military captors in exchange for monetary bounties were found after years of imprisonment to have no connection to terrorism? Hey, no questions asked is a lot simpler solution than going through cross-examination before a jury of your peers, right? Already under the revised Patriot Act, material support for terrorism can include humanitarian aid or even advocating for some suspicious group. Colleen Rowley also writes, corrupted, compliant politicians have already allowed their fears to get the better of them by going along with preemptive war in violation of the Nuremberg Principles and international law and torturing in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture. So why should they also not go for detaining American citizens without constitutional rights or trial? Here's an excerpt from the original version of the NDAA that the House passed. Congress affirms that the Department of Defense has the capability and, upon direction by the President, may conduct offensive operations in cyberspace to defend our nation, allies, and interests. The Pentagon already has on the boards a domain of war plan for the Internet, claiming hostile groups are out to infiltrate its information infrastructure. Here's what Ron Paul had to say about the NDAA. The founders wanted to set a high bar for the government to overcome in order to deprive an individual of life or liberty. To lower that bar is to endanger everyone. When the bar is low enough to include political enemies, our descent into totalitarianism is virtually assured. The Patriot Act, as bad as its violations against the Fourth Amendment were, was just one step down the slippery slope. The president's widely expanded view of his own authority to detain Americans indefinitely on American soil is for the first time in this legislation codified into law. That should chill all of us to our core. Ray McGovern, a retired CIA officer turned political activist, has written that the NDAA reminds him of the extraordinary measures introduced by the Nazis after they took power in 1933. The writer-activist Naomi Wolf points out a lesson of history, drawing on what happened in Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and the Soviet Union, suggesting that Congress has probably signed its own arrest warrant. Congress will no longer be directing and in charge of the military. Rather, the military will be directing and in charge of individual congressional leaders, as well as in charge of everyone else. I hate to say it, but there would be something fitting about some of these same gang members getting incarcerated. This ties into my TV show, Conspiracy Theory, where we expose that Homeland Security had FEMA build 6 internment camps. So when the military goes out and takes people or puts them under arrest, they've got a place to put them. This is outrageous. They're heading us right into martial law. Things are already well in motion, and I'm sure we don't know the half of it. Senator Ron Wyden, a member of the Joint Intelligence Committee, told the Senate in May 2011, when the American people find out how their government has secretly interpreted the Patriot Act, they will be stunned and they will be angry. Wyden added that he couldn't talk about it without disclosing classified information. It just got worse. A few months back, the Federal Restricted Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act of 2011 passed by unanimous consent in the Senate and 388-3 in the House, where only Ron Paul and 2 of his blood brothers voted against it. A title like that sounds innocuous enough, doesn't it? Who wouldn't want to improve the grounds of our grand old institutions? But it's also known as the Trespassing Bill, and one of the main sections states that anyone who knowingly enters or remains in any restricted building or grounds without lawful authority to do so, with the intent to impede or disrupt the orderly conduct of government business or official functions, engages in disorderly or disruptive conduct in or in proximity to any restricted building or grounds, or impedes or disrupts the orderly conduct of government business or official functions, will be punished with a fine or imprisonment for not more than 10 years or both. This area might be where the president or someone else with Secret Service protection is visiting, or a building or ground so restricted in conjunction with an event designated as a special event of national significance. That could be anything that Homeland Security construes it to be, including the two gang conventions or a global summit such as the G20 that likewise draws protesters, or even somebody booing at the speech of a political candidate. And this isn't seen as a violation of the right of the people peaceably to assemble as guaranteed by the First Amendment? But depending on who's defining a national special security event, you could be faced with a federal offense of between 1 and 10 years in prison. Once Obama signs the bill, as he's expected to do, implementing its mandate may not be long in coming. In Chicago, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, Obama's former chief of staff, is getting ready for hosting the G8 and NATO summit meetings in 2012. This will create unanticipated or extraordinary support and security needs. So Emanuel gave himself the power to marshal and deputize the FBI, DEA, ATF, and Department of Justice, along with state and county police and any other law enforcement agencies deemed necessary. Besides which, the city can permanently install new surveillance apparatus and enter into agreements with public or private entities concerning placement, installation, maintenance, or use of video, audio, telecommunications, or other similar equipment. The location of any camera or antenna permanently installed shall be determined pursuant to joint review and approval with the Executive Director of Emergency Management and Communications. In June 2011, way out in eastern North Dakota, police made the first arrests of American citizens with the help of a Predator, a spy drone robot aircraft developed by our military. The CIA uses these to spy on possible nuke sites in Iran and on Pakistani militants. Back in 2005, Congress first authorized Customs and Border Protection to use unarmed drones. Today, according to Michael C. Kostanek, a retired Air Force general who heads up an office supervising the drones, Predators are flown in many areas around the country, not only for federal operators, but also for state and local law enforcement and emergency responders in times of crisis. The ex-police commissioner of New York, Howard Safer, figures drones could help in manhunts like spotting a runaway criminal on a rooftop. But Jane Harmon, who used to chair the House Homeland Security Intelligence Subcommittees, says nobody ever talked about using these to assist local police. "There is no question that this could become something that people will regret," Harmon told the LA Times. "Like when those high-res cameras, heat sensors, and sophisticated radar end up targeting us inside our homes, Congresswoman?" AeroVironment Incorporated, our biggest supplier of small drones to the military, now has plans to shop a small chopper drone to about 18,000 state and local police departments around the country, once the FAA eases up its regulations, of course. The new drone, called Cube, buzzes like that angry bug in Men in Black. It fits in a car trunk, weighs 5.5 pounds, and is remote-controlled by a tablet computer. Keep your eye on the Robot Tech Trade Group, the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, which is already talking about 23,000 new jobs if only our airspace gets opened to commercial drones, though it's not specified whether these jobs will go to humans or robots. Is anyone wondering how come police today are uniformed with military helmets, visors, SWAT shields, shin guards, heavy vests, and ever-increasing firepower? Or why the cops who were pepper-spraying and mounting nighttime raids on the Occupy Wall Street sites have Ninja Turtle outfits along with choppers, special tanks, and sound-blasting vehicles that were pioneered in Iraq? Other innovations from that war, such as wireless fingerprint scanners, are also being used by local PDs to check motorists. In Arizona and elsewhere, facial recognition software from our war zones is being utilized, and Raytheon Corporation just patented a new type of riot shield that puts out low-frequency sound waves that disrupt your respiratory tract and hinder your breathing. Here's a mind-boggling statistic. I'm sure you're well aware of stun guns, which are also known as conducted energy devices. One of these is the taser, which is now widely employed by police forces across the country. According to data collected by Amnesty International, at least 500 people in the United States have died since 2001 after being shocked with tasers, either during their arrest or while in jail. This new brand of what's actually termed a non-lethal weapon has killed 92 people in California, 65 in Florida, and 37 in Texas. There's something called the 1033 program, whereby in 2011, over $500 million of surplus military gear ended up in the hands of American police forces, and orders for this year are up by 400%. Violent crime rates across the country have been declining since the early 1990s, but somehow SWAT teams are increasing. The West Hartford Police Department is now hosting a yearly Connecticut SWAT Challenge, in which dozens of sponsors display their wares, things like thunder sledge tools to smash open chain doors and the black, bulletproof box-like trucks made by Lenco Armored Vehicles that can hold up to 15 officers. Not to be outdone, the cops in Cobb County, Georgia, have an amphibious tank, and the sheriff of Richland County, South Carolina, has an armored personnel carrier with a machine gun that he calls the Peacemaker. Not to mention grants from Homeland Security that allow police departments to buy Bearcats, 16,000-pound bulletproof trucks equipped with battering rams, gun ports, tear gas dispensers, and radiation detectors. And there's no listing of how $34 billion in grant money to local police and government agencies has been spent. By 2014, according to the Homeland Security Research Corps, its market for state and local agencies will reach some $19.2 billion. Just let those occupiers go too far, and they'll find a peacemaker pushing them towards a pacemaker. That seems to be their sentiment of choice. You see, the powers that be are worried about these people's protest movements. A Washington lobbying outfit, Clark, Little, Geduldig, and Cranford, came up with a secret plan on behalf of the American Bankers Association, ABA, looking to undermine their, the protesters, credibility in a profound way, doing things like researching the activists' credit card histories and past criminal records while keeping tabs on social media organizing efforts, the goal being to create negative narratives of the Occupy Wall Street for high-impact media placement to expose the backers of this movement. Did you ever think it might be a smart thing for the activists not to have any visible leaders? The lobbyists wanted $850,000 from the bankers to carry out their opposition research and prevent the Occupy Wall Street folks from having very long-lasting political policy and financial impacts on the companies in the center of the bullseye. They'll even bring Santa Claus into the bargain. When media reports cover the next round of bonuses and contrast it with stories of millions of Americans making do with less this holiday season. After somebody leaked this to MSNBC, the ABA admitted it received the unsolicited memo from the lobbyist and chose not to act on it in any way. You can't say the same about the Police Executive Research Forum, or PERF, which you've probably never heard of. It happens to be an international outfit with strong ties to Homeland Security and local law enforcement. They've also been holding conference calls with mayors and police chiefs around the country concerning the Occupy movement. Some reports are that as many as 40 cities have gotten advice from PERF, after which the evictions of protesters took place soon thereafter. PERF's honchos include Minneapolis Police Chief Tim Dolan, who orchestrated the crackdown on disruptors at the Republican convention in 2008. Former Miami and Philly top cop John Timoney, who dispersed the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas protest in 2003, and current board chair Charles Ramsey, who as D.C.'s main man, coordinated the response to the World Bank and IMF protests. PERF is also in the guidebook business. Their latest is called Managing Major Events, Best Practices from the Field, and a how-to for stopping anarchists and eco-terrorists with undercover teams to grab the bad guys and remove them from the crowd. An earlier handbook called for embedded media to control police messages. Perfect. But we shouldn't be surprised about embedded media, a concept that was pioneered when the Iraq War began. It might raise a few eyebrows, though, to know that school bus drivers are being called into the war on terror, and 20,000 mall security guards are being recruited to spot terrorists among shoppers. If you see something, say something, as George Orwell said. Whoops, that's actually a campaign slogan of Homeland Security, which is expanding its purview from transportation into hotels, sports stadiums, and Walmarts. They're getting some help, as are the local gendarmes, from at least 72 fusion centers around the country, which share info from law enforcement and private companies to quietly spy on Americans. These are now operating in every state, fusing material from cops and citizens, immigration officers, and FBI agents. Between 2004 and 2009, about $426 million in Homeland Security grants went to fund the fusion centers, which also get probably an equal amount from state and local agencies. Has modern technology turned law enforcement into Big Brother? I recently read about a case going before the Supreme Court, United States v. Jones. Antoine Jones was a nightclub owner in D.C. who the Fed suspected was dealing drugs, so they put a GPS device on his car in order to monitor the man around the clock. Sure enough, they ended up finding a lot of cocaine, and Jones was sentenced to life in prison. The U.S. Court of Appeals reversed the conviction, on grounds that the GPS affixed to his car was a warrantless search that violated Jones' Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizure. Hear, hear. But the Obama administration asked the Supreme Court to review the decision, claiming there's no invasion of privacy when you're out to bust a drug trafficker, and so GPS tracking of vehicles ought to be allowed without any judicial permission. The Supreme Court will now decide whether the Fourth Amendment safeguards remain meaningful in the digital age. As writer David Cole says, when widely available technological innovations, including GPS devices, cell phones, computer data mining programs, and the like, make it possible to watch citizens more intimately and comprehensively than was remotely conceivable when the Bill of Rights was adopted. Several federal judges around the country are already more than disturbed about this. Judge Diane P. Wood from Chicago wrote that surveillance using GPS devices make the system that George Orwell depicted in his famous novel 1984 seem clumsy. Chief Judge Alex Kozinski of San Francisco has written that 1984 may have come a bit later than predicted, but it's here at last. Writer Cole raised questions like these. Should the fact that your cell phone company knows and records your location at any given moment mean that the government should be free to demand that information without satisfying Fourth Amendment requirements? Should the long-standing police authority to search an individual upon arrest include reviewing all the texts and emails stored in his smartphone? Should customs officers' authority to search luggage without establishing any cause for suspicion at the border extend to laptop computers, which contain infinitely more private information than most of what could have been carried across the border when the border search doctrine was first created? I'm no stranger to the new surveillance technology. After I was elected governor in 1998, the state sent a big crew over to our house to install a hotline phone, supposedly in case somebody broke in. Call me naive, but it took us a long time to figure out that we were being constantly monitored. But who was I going to complain to? The media would have just said I was being paranoid. Who do you go to about something like this when you can't trust your own government, and you're in it? In fact, you're at the top of it. I feel now like I was way ahead of the times. Here's one they hadn't yet come up with when I was in office. It's hidden software that can't exist on your smartphone and that logs in every phone number, text message, and Google search and reports these to the mobile phone carrier. The software is called Carrier IQ, which strikes me as somebody's bad joke of carrying off your supposed intelligence. When the Android operating system is running, Carrier IQ is always right there in the background without your knowledge. Guess how Carrier IQ identified itself on its website? As the world's leading provider of mobile service intelligence solutions. You can learn more about all this in a YouTube video by Trevor Eckhart. The wave of the future may be merging surveillance with biometrics technology, using a person's facial features or iris patterns to determine their identity. Supposedly, you can tell identical twins apart by scanning the eye's iris. These products are already being sold to police departments. One success story is the Morris device, M-O-R-I-S, a gadget attached to an iPhone that can run face recognition software, take digital fingerprints, and grab an iris scan at a traffic stop. The FBI has in the works a billion-dollar next-generation identification, NGI, system to house iris scans, palm prints, measures of voice and gait, records of tattoos and scars, and photos searchable with facial recognition technology when it's complete in 2014. Most of this information is expected to come from local law enforcement. Other such databases exist at the Department of Defense, Justice, and Homeland Security. And if you really want to talk creepy, Wired magazine has reported that the military has given research grants to several companies to spruce up their drones, to do some TTL, tagging, tracking, and locating of humans. One company's already claiming it can equip drones with facial recognition technology that lets them build a 3D model of a face based on a 2D image, which would then allow the drone to ID someone even in a crowd. According to Noah Shachman's article, the Army also wants to identify potentially hostile behavior and intent in order to uncover clandestine foes. Charles River Analytics is using its Army cache to build a so-called Adversary Behavior Acquisition, Collection, Understanding, and Summarization Abacus tool. The system would integrate data from informants' tips, drone footage, and captured phone calls. Then it would apply a human behavior modeling and simulation engine that would spit out intent-based threat assessments of individuals and groups. Never embarrass the Bureau, as J. Edgar Hoover used to say. Section 215 of the Patriot Act lets a secret national security court issue the FBI an order to go after any tangible things connected to an investigation. In June 2011, it came out that the FBI decided to give significant new powers to its roughly 14,000 agents, allowing them more leeway to search databases, go through household trash, or use surveillance teams to scrutinize the lives of people who have attracted their attention. The Bureau can now even check out people and organizations without firm evidence for suspecting criminal or terrorist activity. A whole new domestic investigations and operations guide is being prepared. Unfortunately for us, I don't think it contains the phrase probable cause. Another newfound FBI strategy is called domain awareness. Basically, that's another way of saying racial profiling. Turns out, surprise, Muslims, African Americans, and Chinese are being targeted for investigation based upon their race or religion. Well, not always. The FBI also targeted a dude who took part in a protest against ExxonMobil, with 3 years of round-the-clock surveillance. National security letters, NSLs as they're called, can be issued by the FBI to libraries, phone companies, banks, internet providers, and others demanding information on somebody and accompanied by a gag order that warns whoever receives the letter to say nothing about it to anyone but a lawyer. About 50,000 of these are said to be sent out every year, so that email and phone contacts can be gathered. You still need a warrant to obtain the contents of these written and verbal communications, but that's rapidly becoming window dressing. The Obama administration has proposed expanding the definition of NSLs so that the websites you visit and the Google searches you make and the books you buy can always be tracked. It's getting pretty ridiculous. Or maybe there are just too many employees with time to kill. There's a new program called SLATT, SLAT, which offers online training for coffee shop owners and tattoo shop artists, among others, about how to spot potential terrorist activities. If customers at internet cafes pay for their coffee with cash, watch out. Another warning tells boat shop owners to be looking out for people wanting to become certified scuba divers. You can check out the actual flyers at http://publicintelligence.net. How far will we go in expanding the definition of a terrorist? FBI documents released under a Freedom of Information Act suit last December talk about animal rights activists being prosecuted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act for simply walking onto a farm and shooting video footage of what they considered cruelty to the domestic animals being bred there, and then rescuing one of them. The act was passed in 2006 at the request of the National Association for Biomedical Research, Fur Commission USA, GlaxoSmithKline, Pfizer, Wyeth, United Egg Producers, National Cattlemen's Association, and many other corporations and business groups that have a financial stake in silencing animal rights activists. Not only interfering with the operations of an animal enterprise got criminalized, but so did installing a reasonable fear in those being protested and causing a loss of profits. Here's one that's chilling from the get-go, but is the cover-up worse in terms of right to know? I'm talking about experiments carried out in the United States and Netherlands, where scientists in the lab created an extremely transmittable form of the avian bird flu virus, which is often lethal to humans but doesn't ordinarily spread. Most of the 600 cases so far, half of them deadly, originated in Asia since 1997. Now, our National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity has requested two publications, Science and Nature, to censor what they planned to report because experimental details and mutation data would enable replication of the experiments. Meaning, a terrorist-inspired pandemic. Well, why are they inventing an airborne H5N1 virus in the first place? They've tweaked it genetically to make it more contagious. And what shocked the researchers was how easy it was. As for Muslims, well, like the old recruitment adage says, Uncle Sam wants you. They're being called to account against the First Amendment for things they've said or put out over the Internet. In September 2011, a Pakistani resident legally living here got indicted by the Justice Department for uploading a YouTube video that was supposedly supporting terrorists, even though it didn't contain a word about violence. In the meantime, the CIA, which by statute only operates overseas, is working with local police departments to do human mapping of various Muslim communities. Informants known as mosque crawlers are busy keeping tabs on ministers' sermons, as well as cafes and bookstores. Let's look a bit deeper at the Internet, that bastion of free speech. To hear Hillary Clinton talk the talk at a conference on Internet freedom held at The Hague last December, America is in the forefront of protecting those rights. Our Secretary of State said boldly, "When ideas are blocked, information deleted, conversations stifled, and people constrained in their choices, the Internet is diminished for all of us. What we do today to preserve fundamental freedoms online will have a profound effect on the next generation of users. The United States wants the Internet to remain a space where economic, political, and social exchanges flourish. To do that, we need to protect people who exercise their rights online, and we also need to protect the Internet itself from plans that would undermine its fundamental characteristics. Except, few have done more in recent times to undermine those fundamental characteristics than Mrs. Clinton and the administration she's now serving in. I'm talking first and foremost about WikiLeaks. Now, it's understandable that Hillary would be more than a bit put out by some of the State Department cables released by Julian Assange and his team. After all, she's been exposed for ordering spying by our diplomats on their counterparts at the United Nations. She's gone after credit card numbers, email addresses, phone, fax, and pager numbers, and even frequent flyer account numbers. All actions that our government had condemned as illegal. And it turns out her State Department had pressured Spain to shut down independent investigations into the Bush administration's torture policies. In retaliation, the United States went after WikiLeaks big time. In fact, what Australian diplomatic cables called an unprecedented U.S. government criminal investigation, both in its scale and nature. The United States convened a grand jury, mounted cyber attacks to stop WikiLeaks from being hosted in the USA, detained their supporters at airports, and grabbed their laptops without a warrant. The White House warned government employees not to even look at the documents online, even though the world's largest newspapers were publishing them and threatened that they would be breaking the law if they did. It gets worse in the wake of WikiLeaks, justifying the group's founder, Julian Assange, calling the Internet the most significant surveillance machine that we have ever seen. Here's what Glenn Greenwald reported on the Salon.com website. The Obama administration, following in the footsteps of Saudi Arabia, is seeking a new federal law forcing Internet email, instant messaging, and other communication providers offering encryption to build in back doors for law enforcement surveillance. The Obama DOJ has insisted that it has the right to read opened emails with no warrants from a court. The chairwoman of the Democratic Party, Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, is sponsoring a bill under which Internet providers would be forced to keep logs of their customers' activities for 1 year. The Washington Post's Dana Priest and William Arkin reported in their Top Secret America series last year, everyday collection systems at the National Security Agency intercept and store some 1.7 billion emails, phone calls, and other types of communications. The FBI has a request out to tech firms to develop a program that would enable agents to sift through waves of publicly available information. The goal is to develop a sort of early warning system that provides real-time intelligence to improve the FBI's overall situational awareness. It's more than a bit curious that DARPA, D-A-R-P-A, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which invented the Internet, is now working with the FBI and CIA in search of a program to monitor social media chatter like Twitter. Meantime, Homeland Security is already busy checking out the social media websites and even has an operating procedure manual for doing so. The assault on our privacy is, not surprisingly, being farmed out from government to private corporations. Homeland Security outsourced their social media monitoring program to General Dynamics, the big military contractor, mainly scoping out keywords, they say. It came out at a congressional hearing in February 2012 that if you're the first person to tweet about a news story, or if you're a community activist who makes public Facebook posts, DHS will have your personal information. In December 2011, WikiLeaks released the spy files, nearly 300 documents that shed light on this alliance, and caused Julian Assange to say, "What we are seeing is the militarization of cyberspace. It's like having a tank in your front garden." A few examples of what we now know. A brochure from SS8, a Milpitas, California company, is pushing a product called Intelligo that lets security forces see what they see in real time, including a target's draft-only emails, attached files, pictures, and videos. Glimmer Glass, based in Hayward, California, has equipment that allows government to secretly tap into the undersea cables that convey all the data and phone traffic between continents. Another California outfit, Blue Coat of Sunnyvale, sells web filtering tools that let countries block dissident websites to meet cultural and regulatory requirements. Syria bought some Blue Coat machines from a reseller in Dubai, since because of U.S. sanctions, the company can't sell these directly to the Syrians. But hey, it's all in the name of tracking down crooks and terrorists, right? The new moniker is Lawful Interception. In late February, WikiLeaks started publishing the Global Intelligence Files, over 5 million emails gleaned from Stratfor, a Texas-based private intel outfit that fronts as a publisher while offering confidential intelligence services to Homeland Security, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Marine Corps, and also big corporations such as Dow Chemical, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. Incidentally, Stratfor was also out to destroy WikiLeaks. These documents indicate there's a secret indictment waiting to be served on Assange under the 1917 Espionage Act. Stratfor's vice president for intelligence is Fred Burton, who used to be deputy chief of the State Department's Counterterrorism Division. They've channeled tips to Israel's Mossad spy outfit and gave a complimentary membership to the ex-head of Pakistan's intel service. They did secret deals with dozens of media organizations and journalists from Reuters to the Kiev Post. In 2009, Stratfor CEO George Friedman got together with Goldman Sachs' then-managing director, Shay Morenz, and came up with the notion to utilize the intelligence from its insider network to set up StratCap, to trade in a range of geopolitical instruments, particularly government bonds, currencies, and the like. Morenz in 2011 invested substantially more than $4 million and joined the Stratfor board of directors. WikiLeaks won't comment on who leaked them all, the Stratfor emails, which I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about. Some activist hackers who call themselves anonymous are saying they're the leakers. Anonymous already took some interesting steps after 86 senators signed off on the National Defense Authorization Act that I wrote about earlier. They did a massive dump of previously undisclosed information about these guys, beginning with, "Robert J. Portman is a Republican senator from the state of Ohio. We are truly disturbed by the ludicrous $272,853 he received from special interest groups supporting the NDAA bill that authorizes the indefinite detention of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. Robert J. Portman, we plan to make an example of you. Finally, there's SOPA, S-O-P-A, the Stop Online Piracy Act, supposedly aimed at expanding what law enforcement and copyright holders can do to fight the rogue websites that are peddling their goods, most of them based overseas. Under the Act, if someone did streaming of copyrighted content without authorization, it would be a felony. The bill attempts a radical restructuring of the laws governing the Internet, according to Gary Shapiro, CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association. The information tech magazine eWeek says, "The language of SOPA is so broad, the rules so unconnected to the reality of Internet technology, and the penalties so disconnected from the alleged crimes that this bill could effectively kill e-commerce or even normal Internet use." For example, one amendment lets anybody seek court action to restrain a website's activities, but the State Department has already been lobbying other countries for strict new laws like SOPA. They have even offered to fund enforcement and literally draft the laws that sacrifice free speech for greater copyright protection for Hollywood. It hasn't passed Congress yet, but don't look for SOPA to go away anytime soon. Is this called No More WikiLeaks Ever Again because the security state would now have the power to censor and shut down the Internet? More than 1 million people have signed an online petition in protest of the SOPA legislation, but unbelievably, the entertainment industry seemed oblivious. Or maybe not, since the LA Times has reported that the recording industry is pushing California's lawmakers to approve legislation that would allow warrantless searches of companies that press copies of compact discs and DVDs. The bill has no standard for suspecting that counterfeiting is occurring, and would give law enforcement officials the power to enter manufacturing plants without notice or court orders. In the meantime, one state is talking about making it a criminal act to share your Netflix password with your friends or family, because that's taking away from Netflix revenues. One last example of your corporate police state at work. You may have heard about fracking, short for hydraulic fracturing, whereby chemicals are injected into the earth at high pressure to bring up oil and gas. The documentary Gasland points out the dangers which a growing number of environmental activists are fighting. Filmmaker Josh Fox got led out in handcuffs after trying to film a House Science Committee hearing on fracking in January 2012. At an industry conference in Houston, the communications director for Range Resources, Matt Pizzarella, explained how we have several former PSYOPs folks that work for us, very much having that understanding of PSYOPs in the Army and in the Middle East, has applied very helpfully here for us in Pennsylvania. Another speaker suggested his colleagues download the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Manual, because we are dealing with an insurgency here. PSYOPs and military manuals to put down citizen dissent. One of our founders, Benjamin Franklin, had this to say: "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." Is this the unpretty pass that we've reached? Is our Constitution still a living document? You be the judge. Chapter 16. Third Parties in America. I used to hold out a lot of hope for a third-party movement in America, having had some success that way myself. Before getting into the personal part a little, let me do a quick historical review of how third parties came into being and generally faded from sight almost as quickly. First, it's good to keep in mind that new parties have sprung up whenever there is a crisis in the country. With Andrew Jackson, the people were demanding more representation. The Republican Party came about through the North-South crisis. The populist and Grange parties came out of an economic crisis in the rural Midwest, which led to William Jennings Bryan, who really did represent the farmers and was destroyed by the big money interests. "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold," Bryan famously said in 1896. However, they could, and did, and they still are. A capsule history of third parties might go like this. The Liberty Party, founded in 1840, died in 1852. Dedicated to the abolition of slavery, it suffered from a lack of organization, but also of media coverage. The Democrats and the Whigs largely ignored the issue of slavery as much as they could, and so newspapers of the day barely covered any news about the Liberty Party. Their best results were in New England and New York. The Free Soil Party, founded in 1848, died in 1854, but essentially turned into the Republican Party when John Fremont ran in 1856. It was originally dedicated to not extending slavery into the new territories recently acquired from Mexico. Also lacking in organization, the Free Soil Party performed best in two New England states, Vermont and Massachusetts, and also in Wisconsin. The Know-Nothing Party, also called the American Party, founded in 1845, died in 1860. This was very much a reaction to large waves of European immigrants who'd come in search of a better economic situation. These new immigrants were largely Catholics, and the Know-Nothings were mainly Protestants. Their party split on North-South lines over the issue of slavery, but they did get some state legislators elected. The Constitutional Union Party, founded in 1859, died in 1860. When the Know-Nothings splintered into northern and southern camps, the Southerners bolted to this one. Few parties, major or minor, have ever been so intent on avoiding the issues, according to the book Third Parties in America. The Greenback Party, founded in 1874, died in 1884. This was one of the most effective third parties in our history. Farmers in rural America were being gouged by the railroad companies and finding it difficult to manage the cost of their produce shipments. So they organized into clubs called Grangers and tried to push the government to regulate the rates of railroads. After first forming alliances with Democrats in 1876, they held a convention and adopted a platform which included a United States note issued directly by the government. 2 years later, they garnered over 1 million votes and 14 congressional seats, with the strongest support in the Midwest. The lasting legacy of the Greenback Party, government-backed currency, government labor bureaus, and a shorter work week are today regarded as common features of American industrial society. The People's Party, a.k.a. the Populist Party, founded in 1891, died in 1908. The more things change, the more they stay the same. After the Civil War, as many settlers migrated westward, banks in the East offered what today might be called predatory loans and sent land values skyrocketing, until the Depression in 1887 sent them tumbling again. But the monopolistic railroad outfits then set arbitrary prices that made it impossible for a farmer to pay off his debt. The populist platform called for government ownership of railroads, free coinage of silver, and a graduated income tax. They won majorities in 7 Midwestern Western states and rural areas across the South. But guess what? The Democrats co-opted the free silver idea, and many populists found it easier to remain in the Democratic fold, thus bringing an end to the sequence of minor parties rooted in the hardships of the farmer and laborer. The Prohibition Party, founded in 1869, is still active today. They netted 643 votes in 2008 as the National Statesman, a name adopted in 1980. Like the original name suggests, these folks revolved around issues of temperance and the prohibition of alcohol and other controlled substances. They're the longest-running third party in American politics, with candidates in every presidential election since 1872. In fact, they were the first party to endorse women's suffrage, direct election of senators, in income tax and child labor laws. My favorite third-party candidate was Theodore Roosevelt. As a Republican, he'd been president from 1901 to 1909 and anointed William Howard Taft as his successor. But when Taft didn't continue down the same progressive path, and Roosevelt couldn't convince the Republican National Committee not to renominate him, Teddy bolted from the Republicans and set up the Progressive Party / Bull Moose Party. Here's what his platform declared in 1912. To destroy this invisible government, to dissolve the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of the day. The platform echoed earlier Greenback and populist ones. The direct election of senators, direct primaries, women's suffrage, publication of campaign expenditures, regulation of interstate industry, a minimum wage, unemployment insurance, and old age pensions. Roosevelt won 27% of the vote, to this day the best a third party candidate has ever done. but Woodrow Wilson co-opted a number of their ideas for the Democrats, and the Progressive Party machinery, hamstrung by infighting and lack of money and patronage, decayed. The Socialist Labor Party, SLP, created in 1876, died in 2008. This was a byproduct of an economic transition that left in many Americans the feeling that they had been left behind. They saw collective ownership over the means of production as the solution, and they were strong in the West and among immigrants. They also didn't want the country to enter World War I without the government holding a plebiscite of the people. That, not surprisingly, led to the Espionage Act of 1917, which allowed various government agencies to go after the SLP and its leaders. Cops and vigilantes were soon derailing their activities. Even though they hung in there and had a brief surge of popularity during the Depression, they've had next to zero impact on election outcomes or on public policy. The Socialist Party of Eugene Debs and Norman Thomas came out of a split with the SLP, and many of their proposals became a part of mainstream Democratic politics, like labor laws, Social Security, and Medicare. Much of what became Franklin D. Roosevelt's social policies began with the Socialists. They were also involved in civil rights issues with A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin before the major parties got involved, and had a lot of influence on Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Of course, since they wanted redistribution of wealth in some way, basically by taking money from the rich and powerful, they got no positive play in the media, then or now. They were derided as a bunch of dirty commies, but in actuality were trying to create a more fair society, not by government giveaways, but by taking some of the ill-gotten gains from the rich who owned the government. In my home state, in the 1920s, arose the populist Minnesota Farmer Labor Party, which existed independently until it was absorbed by the Democratic Party in 1944. The original platform called for protecting farmers and union workers, along with the public owning railroads, utilities, and natural resources. Between 1921 and 1941, they managed to elect 4 U.S. senators, 8 U.S. representatives, and 3 governors. Hubert Humphrey orchestrated the merger into the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, which exists to this day on the Minnesota ballot. Robert La Follette, a fellow I greatly admire, had tried to reform the Republicans from within. He bolted from the GOP in 1924 after he failed to get nominated to the national ticket, and his followers formed the Conference for Progressive Political Action, CPAA. La Follette had championed the rights of Native Americans and African Americans, at the same time opposing the entry of U.S. forces into World War I. The Socialist Party sometimes worked with La Follette, and he was also, according to the book The American Radical, the most important and recognized leader of the opposition to the growing dominance of corporations over government. The CPAA actually got La Follette's name on the ballot in every state except Louisiana, and he netted 17% of the national vote in the 1924 presidential election. Henry Wallace, who'd been FDR's vice president, got dropped from the national ticket in 1944 in favor of Harry Truman. Wallace and Truman didn't see eye to eye about the Cold War and foreign policy. Wallace preferred resolving things through the newly formed United Nations, while Truman felt military strength was more important. So to protest Truman's policies, Wallace made an unsuccessful run for president in 1948 and netted 2.4% of the vote. Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrats were the popular opposite of Wallace in 1948, a states' rights party that wanted to continue segregation of black from white. Thurmond did take 4 states in the South, but the Truman campaign somewhat co-opted the more palatable aspects of the Dixiecrat message, and Truman took 6 states. The Dixiecrats died in 1951. The next year, Eisenhower and Stevenson both worked hard to win back Dixiecrats to their gangs. Incensed by John F. Kennedy's policies aimed at desegregation of the South, George Wallace formed the American Independent Party, AIP, in an effort to send Washington a message that the nation's blacks had pushed too far too fast. Supporters managed to get Wallace on the ballot in all 50 states in 1968, and he went on to win 5 Southern states and 13.8% of the national vote. On May 16, 1972, Wallace was shot and paralyzed, and the AIP soon splintered into being irrelevant. Wallace was famous for pithy and often offensive campaign rhetoric that revolved around phrases like law and order, a phrase that Nixon's Republican gang co-opted in their campaign rhetoric toward a Southern strategy to realign most Southern voters with them. In 1980, something new and different happened. John B. Anderson, a moderate Republican congressman from Illinois, decided to go independent after he failed to get the nomination and ended up getting 6 million votes. I draw a comparison to what we might be seeing today with Ron Paul's presidential candidacy as a maverick Republican congressman from Texas. Like Paul, Anderson wasn't afraid to raise break-the-mold issues. He'd introduced legislation and made it the signature of his run, calling for a 50-cent-a-gallon tax on gasoline simultaneous with a 50% reduction in Social Security taxes. This would have put us well on the road to better fuel efficiency, long before global warming was being talked about, and would also have benefited the middle class. Anderson told it like it was, and still is. The idea that you could lower taxes, raise defense spending, and have a balanced budget was a pipe dream. In the primaries, he was a serious contender for the Republican nomination, which eventually went to Ronald Reagan. Anderson then ran as an independent and not only found enough support to get on the ballot in every state, but also raised enough money to make a strong bid. The League of Women Voters said he met the qualification threshold of higher than 15% in the polls, so he could be allowed into the debates against Reagan and then-President Jimmy Carter. But Carter said he wouldn't appear on the same stage with Anderson, who did pretty well one-on-one against Reagan. The next time, Reagan debated Carter alone, and, in the end, a lot of Anderson's supporters decided to vote for Reagan. But Anderson still had the sixth best showing of any third-party or independent candidate of the 20th century. Ever since, he's been calling for some way to change the two-party gridlock on our political system. It seems that about every dozen years or so, people get fed up enough with the two gangs for a new third-party or lately independent candidate to appear on the horizon. In 1992, along came Ross Perot, the billionaire businessman from Texas. At one point, he was ahead of both Bill Clinton and then-President George H.W. Bush in the polls. He might well have gone on to victory, but suddenly Perot dropped out of the race because he claimed Republican operatives had tried to disrupt his daughter's wedding. When he came back in that October, he'd lost two crucial months. I suspect that Perot never actually wanted to win. He only wanted to make a statement. And as the momentum for him built up that summer, he got scared that he might pull it off. As it was, he was allowed into the presidential debates and Perot captured 19% of the popular vote. Only Teddy Roosevelt ever did better. I admired Perot at the time, in a classic case of being co-opted by one of the gangs, in this case for a good cause. One of Perot's key campaign issues was to reduce the federal deficit. After Clinton went on to become president, he incorporated reduction of the deficit as an administration policy, and he balanced it too, until George W. Bush plunged the deficit into the toilet. Republicans also stole from Ross Perot. Their 1994 contract with America included support for term limits, a line item veto, and a balanced budget amendment. It was no accident that, when the Republicans took the midterm election in 94, two-thirds of the people who'd voted for Perot voted for them. In 1995, Perot had established the Texas Reform Party, and the next year, our independent party of Minnesota affiliated with them because we saw a chance to go national. By the time different affiliates from third parties around the country came together for the presidential election of 96, Dick Lamb had joined the movement. He'd been a three-time governor of Colorado. He was a very bright guy and a savvy politician. Some of us wanted Dick to be the Reform Party's nominee that year. But at the 11th hour, the Perot forces undercut Lamb and put the Texas billionaire up again as the candidate. Our group from Minnesota and a lot of others then started to question what was really happening. Apparently, Perot and his crowd didn't want to have a legitimate third-party movement. Maybe it was all about Perot's ego. And, of course, his money. He did get 8% of the popular vote in 96, which was still respectable for a third-party candidate. But that time, the gangs had seen the light about letting him into the debates. When Perot scared the pants off the two gangs in 92, that had entitled him to almost $30 million of our tax dollars, just like the big boys, if he needed it for another campaign. But in 96, Congress changed the rules for the debates. The League of Women Voters got dumped and a new federal debate commission was created, appointed by the former heads of the Republican and Democratic National Parties, gangs. Two of the appointees to the commission had been the former heads of the gangs. Do you think our forefathers would rubber stamp that baby? Clinton was running for re-election against Bob Dole, who didn't want Perot allowed in the debates because that might cut in on Dole's conservative base. Clinton was so far ahead in the polls that debates could only bring his numbers down. So he and Dole made a backroom deal. They'd keep Perot out if Clinton could say how many debates and where they'd be held. They took their plan to the Federal Election Commission, which naturally gave it the go-ahead. That year, only two debates took place, guaranteed to have a small audience because they were on the same nights as the World Series. The two gangs keep any independent or third-party candidates from having too much clout through a variety of methods. First, they exercise control over who can get onto a state ballot. That is usually determined by a Secretary of State, who is a member of one of the gangs. Another way to squelch a third party is through FECA. That's the Federal Election Commission Act, passed back in 1974, a so-called reform that actually freezes out third-party challengers. I call this a fecal matter because this law made it legal to protect the two gangs from a third-party upset by allocating huge sums of federal money only to candidates of the Democrats or Republicans until after an election is over. And an independent can only get it after November, if he already appeared on the ballot in at least 10 states and took 5% or more of the popular vote. As the book Third Parties in America says, the FECA is a major party protection act. So what can be summarized about third parties? One, they usually bubble up to the national level due to some sort of political instability or perceived crisis. Two, they usually congeal around one issue or a set of related issues. Minor parties often advocate policies not embraced by the major parties. Often these new positions can be accommodated with relatively little discomfort to the major party. Three, third parties usually have a brief shelf life. Four, third parties are usually personality-driven or issue-driven. Five, third parties are usually regionally based and/or with regional appeal. Six, third parties usually suffer from a lack of media coverage or too much media coverage that borders on mainstream ridicule. 7. Third-party candidates usually do not participate in televised presidential debates, though Perot in 1992 was a notable exception to this rule. 8. Third parties usually suffer from the double-edged sword that is public perception. Voters don't support a fringe character or a candidate likely to not win a major election. 9. Third parties usually suffer from a lack of financial resources. They've never appeared to have the same fundraising donor cultivation abilities of the Democrats or the Republicans. A little more personal history might be relevant. When I first ran for office to become mayor of my then hometown of Brooklyn Park, the heads of the Minnesota Republican Party and Democratic Party co-signed a letter sent to every resident in the mail stating that they endorsed my opponent. They called me the most dangerous man in the city. All I was a citizen, but thinking about it, maybe they were being accurate, because I'd been a Navy SEAL and then a pro wrestler, which makes me a pretty tough guy. We were the Independence Party before we affiliated with the Reform Party because we really believed a national third party was starting out of Texas and Ross Perot. So we became the Reform Party of Minnesota. Put it this way, a third gang was formed temporarily. I've written some in my earlier books about what happened between me and Ross Perot and the Reform Party. It left a bitter taste in my mouth, that's for sure. But don't take my word for it. Here's what author Micah L. Sifry had to say in his 2002 book, Spoiling for a Fight, Third Party Politics in America. If it weren't for Jesse Ventura's establishment shocking victory in the Minnesota governor's race on November 3, 1998, the Reform Party might well have been declared dead by the mainstream media well in advance of the 2000 election. Ventura was almost the political inverse of Perot. Ventura was sane, funny, self-deprecating, and grounded in the reality of working people's lives, not a secluded, kooky billionaire surrounded by sycophants. He was a patriot like Perot, but not an anti-foreigner demagogue. He was also a real libertarian who never tried to buy a politician or get a government subsidy, unlike Perot, who was a big donor to Richard Nixon and other Washington insiders. Couldn't have said it better myself. Of course, like the author went on to point out, Perot was quick to take credit for my upset, calling it a major victory for the Reform Party. The truth was, Perot hadn't done squat to help my campaign, nor had any of the other reformers. They wouldn't even give me a donation, not to mention a loan. I'd voted for Perot twice in presidential elections, in 92 and again in 96, and when I ran for governor, I needed his help. In Minnesota, there's a system where people check off some money on their tax returns that goes into a general fund for distribution to candidates running for office. I was supposed to get more than $325,000 to finance my campaign, a smaller percentage than my two opponents. But to get the funds, first you had to take out a loan from a bank, which, after the election, the government would repay as long as you got at least 5% of the vote. But the powers that be in Minnesota were doing their best to stymie me. So I flew to Atlanta with some of my people for a meeting with Perot. We figured he must know a bank in Texas that could grant the loan. He probably even owned some banks. But he wouldn't even look us in the eye. I knew he wasn't going to lift a finger to help us, and I also knew that his version of the Reform Party was bogus. The head of the Minnesota Banking Association at the time happened to be Bill Cooper, who was also chairman of the Republican Party. You do the math. A half dozen banks turned me down, and there was only a month to go before the election. That's when the Franklin Avenue Bank came through, thanks to a member of our Reform Party on the Minneapolis City Council who talked to their vice president one day over a backyard fence. That loan paid for the advertising that, after the debates, helped me win the election. A poll taken by Republican gang member Frank Luntz at the time showed that nearly a third of registered voters would have considered voting for me if I'd run for president in 2000. But I'd made a four-year obligation to the people of Minnesota, and I just didn't believe that, for your own personal political gain, you start suddenly campaigning for another job. So my team began pushing for a viable third-party candidate, and we made clear we didn't mean Ross Perot. Originally, the 1999 Reform Party convention was scheduled to be held in Minnesota, but basically to snub me, they moved it to Dearborn, Michigan. Then I came out and supported a non-Perot guy, Jack Gargan, for National Reform Party chair. I couldn't make it to the convention because of a thunderstorm, but I did address the delegates by phone and thank Perot for a job well done. When he spoke the next day, for almost 40 minutes, he never once mentioned my name or the fact that I was the party's top-ranking public official. Jack Gargan told the convention, "If you don't realize that Governor Ventura's victory is our ticket to party survival and build on that victory, then don't vote for me." They saw the light. Jack won. But that was about the peak of it. I tried like hell to recruit a good man to lead the Reform Party national ticket in 2000. John McCain had just started to take on George W. Bush that year when he came to see me in Minneapolis. At the time, he was a moderate and a veteran, and I was supporting him. I told McCain that if he'd quit the Republican Party, I'd break my promise to Minnesota and run on the ticket with him. But he said he couldn't do that. If he and I had run together, I think there's a strong chance we could have won as independents. I also talked to Colin Powell, Lowell Weicker, and even Donald Trump. They all ultimately said no. I might have considered running with General Powell as well. Unfortunately, or maybe as fate would have it, he'd already hitched his wagon to Bush's star. As Secretary of State, his speech about Iraq's supposed weapons of mass destruction was the deciding factor in pushing us into a war based on lies. Needless to say, I imagine General Powell regrets that today. Anyway, Pat Buchanan ended up being the Reform Party's man of the hour. To me, he carried way too much of a religious agenda, and I'm a firm believer in separating church and state. After the Perot crowd attacked me publicly, following a controversial interview I did for Playboy, even calling on me to drop out of the party, I gave them what they wanted. I called a press conference on the front steps of the governor's mansion, brought the key members of my team together from the third-party movement in Minnesota, and said, "The National Reform Party is hopelessly dysfunctional." I quit and aligned myself with Angus King, the governor of Maine, who belonged to no party, and said I was going to change our state party's name back to Independence. Pat Buchanan ended up getting just 422,368 votes nationwide in 2000, which comes out to a meager 0.43%. As the book Spoiling for a Fight says, for all intents and purposes, the Reform Party experiment was dead. Basically, Buchanan hijacked the Reform Party, and I'm sure he had plenty of help from Republican operatives. His candidacy was a great way to destroy momentum for a third party. The Reform Party self-destructed, and it was a darn shame. Ralph Nader ended up running in the 2000s, and after the Supreme Court handed Bush the election over Al Gore, a lot of pundits said it was all Nader's fault for taking votes away from Gore. Baloney. This isn't about picking the winner of a horse race. People voted for Nader because they wanted him to become president. Don't free elections mean voting your heart and your conscience no matter what? Besides, like other independents before him, Nader brought up a lot of topics that the two gangs wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. Since that time, and since deciding not to run again for governor in 2002, I've been doing a great deal of thinking about third parties. My position is that the only way a third party can survive is to become as bad as the two that we already have, which just adds another entity we have to try to squash eventually. Instead of being a two-headed monster, we'll simply create a three-headed monster, a Hydra. The way to take our government back is to defang and disarm what we've got now and make them no different than any other special interest group with no more power. We've got a ferocious animal running amok in our neighborhoods, and we need to turn it into a house cat or dog. I'd make only one exception to the rule in 2012, and that's if Ron Paul decides to make a third-party run.